Okay, so my guest today on Newton Talks is Dr. Dieter de Klerk, who is a lecturer in media and film at the University of Kent. Now, Dieter did his PhD on satire. Is that correct, Dieter?
That is very correct, James.
So, as a starting question, what attracted you to the subject of satire? Why did you want to do a PhD on that subject?
Well, I mean, it must have been The Simpsons for me. I remember, I'm not quite sure when I started watching The Simpsons. It was on Belgian television, one of the commercial stations. And I think it was like The Simpsons at 6, 2 episodes, and then The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air at 7.
Right.
I quite vividly remember it. And I think it must have been in primary school. And I was just like, it was amazing. It like rocked my world, I think. And I think in retrospect, you know, I'm from a fairly small village in Belgium where nothing was going on. And I'm not quite sure if I realized that at the time. I had a really happy childhood. But, you know, there's that song by the Velvet Underground, like rock and roll, and about, you know, a village where nothing's going on and the protagonist, her life is saved by rock and roll. You know, there's nothing going on at all, and then rock and roll came by. And I think The Simpsons, for me, was that moment. It became really important for me, and I think it started shaping my worldview when I was in secondary school. I went to a Catholic school because it's Belgium, so Catholic schools are quite common in Belgium. It's not because you're particularly religious that you go to a Catholic school. But the school had a particular kind of ethos that didn't really go well with me. It was quite sort of authoritarian. And, you know, later, having read, you know, you study and, you know, you do humanities, you come across Foucault at some point, I imagine. And it's a kind of discipline. And I remember moments where we had to go into the building in rows of two and then be silent when we walked into the building before we went into the classroom. And that sat with me very uneasy. And The Simpsons was this kind of, you know, I was almost going to say anarchic, but I shouldn't say that with you. Or we can more examine that more closely later. But The Simpsons was this kind of countercultural force. And I think it was sort of countercultural to an extent. It was on mainstream television, but maybe for the environment I was in, that was kind of the closest thing I'd get to.
Yeah, and we've obviously talked about this briefly before we started recording. And there's I've never seen The Simpsons, or the only episode I've ever seen of The Simpsons is the one that you asked me to watch, or one of the ones you asked me to watch in advance of this podcast.
That's amazing. We could do an entire podcast about that, you not having seen The Simpsons, but yeah.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons why I just find the animation style really, really off-putting.
Oh, that's, yeah.
I find it aesthetically, it makes me feel physically sick.
Does it?
I wouldn't go as far as to say that. I find it utterly repulsive. I realise I'm in a minority when it comes to that. But one thing I find interesting, though, is, and you mentioned you were quite young when you saw this, did you say secondary school?
I think even primary school. So before I was 10, I imagine.
You were 10, you were watching it. And I know my son was watching it from a very young age.
Yeah.
So you've got this almost kind of satirical take on American life.
Absolutely.
That kids are interested in from a very, very young age. Unlike something like Family Guy, where it's clearly aimed at an older person. The gags are far more adult. Whereas The Simpsons is far aimed at a younger person as well as adults.
Well, especially the persona of Bart Simpson. And I think The Simpsons started off centering around Bart as this kind of hellraiser, sort of borderline sociopath, but I mean, later on we had Family Guy and South Park, and you know, Bart Simpson was, you know, that was a cultural crisis when that happened, and now it looks all quite tame. Maybe that's partly, you know, it was that kind of cultural counterculture, but not too much. I think maybe that's partly what I liked about it as well. And you know, that was like I almost want to say a lifesaver for me, The Simpsons. It's comedy, it's humor, and I guess the kind of just aesthetic enjoyment of The Simpsons. I thought it was so good, and I think, you know, I rewatched a couple of episodes now, and they're from like 1993, and you can tell it from then, but in a way they're not dated yet. I imagine if you watch like a sitcom from the early 1990s, it would be far more dated. And I think The Simpsons was really clever and really intelligent. And in terms of storytelling, at least in the early seasons, it was really good storytelling as well. I think it still stands.
So you asked me to watch an episode from season 4.
Yeah.
What kind of date was that? Was that mid-90s? 1993. So I've just watched an episode called Lisa the Beauty Queen.
Yeah.
And I would agree with you and that it didn't seem dated. And 1993 seems like a long...
I know.
It does not seem like it was... No. I agree with you on that. It did seem very, very fresh. And I have to say, there were a few quite funny jokes in it. You know, I like Homer's... the way Homer talks about women and compliments. And there's a really funny bit where Lisa's the beauty queen and one of her duties is welcoming... Or she thinks she's welcoming immigrants coming in on a boat, but it turns out they're being deported, which I thought was very, very amusing.
But it has that kind of very... I think I randomly went into my collection of Simpsons DVDs and I thought, oh, you know, I'll pick season 4. By that time, its satirical worldview is really established. And I'll just pick a few random episodes. And I thought, oh, Lisa the Beauty Queen, that's a good one because it's Laramie Cigarettes, which is the kind of brand of cigarettes in The Simpsons. And there's this CEO who says, unfortunately, we're not allowed to advertise directly to children. But what we can do is we can offer, you know, we can organize a beauty pageant for children aged 7 to 9. And Homer goes, Lisa's aged 7 to 9?
Yeah.
And it's got that moment, I think, is part of its satirical worldview is, of course, the advertising, the cigarette company, but also kind of Homer's influence or how Homer's influenced by television and by marketing on television. Now, of course, if The Simpsons, I mean, it's still going, but nobody watches it, but if The Simpsons would have started in our days, it would all be about smartphones and vloggers and whatever, but I'm not quite sure if it would have worked out well, but it was very much about, it was television about television.
In the episode that I watched, it's interesting how Lisa gets a kind of complex because she feels ugly.
Yeah.
But she gets it because she has a caricature drawn of herself.
Yes.
At a fair.
Yeah.
And I could see how, yes, if you were updating it now, it would maybe be some social media critique rather than something like that. But it's quite interesting how it's this deliberately exaggerated representation of herself that she takes as evidence that she's ugly. I thought that was quite an interesting
And I think it's probably, in a sense, timeless. I think, you know, the self-image, young people, you know, I think it was happening at the time in the early 1990s, it's happening still today, and I think, yeah, you could still, in fact, I'm going to try it, I think you could still watch The Simpsons today and these older episodes. I mean, I'm doing a module later on in the year on quality TV and complex television, and I'm taking it over from a colleague, and I think I'm going to try and sneak in some of The Simpsons, because I mean, The Simpsons was voted best television show of, was it the century or the millennium, by Time magazine in 2000. And I think we were talking about it being television about television. It was mocking all the television. It was very clever about being different from other kinds of television. So in a sense, like what HBO was doing or is doing, like, it's not normal television. It's not television. The Simpsons was already doing it at the same time. And I think it's, for a lot of reasons, an important television show, but for me it's the kind of, yeah, the satirical worldview, the kind of going against the establishment at the time. I think for a teenager who's in a Catholic school in Belgium, not having a good time, that was really important.
So where is your research gone recently around satire? How are you researching the topic now? What is your interest in the topic now?
Well, my interest in the topic now is about satire and mental health. And
mental health.
Yeah. And I'm interested in that because I've kind of stumbled on the limitations of satire as a form of kind of politics or the political effects of satire. So if it's okay with you, we could have a chat about that and then how that kind of informed the direction in my research now towards mental health. And it's this idea, I think a lot of scholarship about The Simpsons and commercial satire is about this paradox of you have content which is countercultural, but everything else about the program is really deeply, deeply commercial and deeply mainstream. And there's there's another episode I watched recently, and it was about Camp Krusty, and it's like Krusty the Clown, who's television entertainer for children, but also corporate sellout. And Bart and Lisa go to this Camp Krusty, and he's kind of licensed the camp with his name, and then has nothing to do with it, and it all goes horribly wrong. And at the end, he's confronted with the children. And Bart says to Krusty, Krusty, how could you? I would never lend my name to an inferior product. And of course, the joke is that by that time, The Simpsons was also so heavily franchised and licensed. I think it was, at that time, the television show with the most licenses, like Burger King and everything. So the writers at that point were already kind of aware of the irony of what they were doing. But the corporation, which was owned by Rupert Murdoch, I mean, it doesn't get much worse than that, was of course, deeply commercial. And there's a kind of anti-capitalistic, there's a criticism of capitalism in The Simpsons, but itself is like this capitalistic juggernaut. So a lot of the research, I think, on satire recently has been about this kind of paradox, and, you know, can satire have a kind of political effect if it is nonetheless so commercial, or is it cynical? And I was kind of really interested in that, and I think at some point, and this was quite difficult for me to deal with, I had to kind of accept, and this will sound silly, but there's more radical things than The Simpsons, and you've written about them, for example. And that was quite, you know, also personal for me, because I felt like the limitations of where I am in my political life as well, that I feel like I'm not radical enough, I'm not progressive enough, I'm not kind of... And that was when I was starting to become interested in these questions of mental health, because they're kind of issues of how you live in the world. And we live in an era where, you know, you've got Brexit anxiety is a thing, climate grief is a thing. I read recently that in Belgium there's now the first psychotherapist whose specialty is, you know, climate grief or climate anxiety, or, you know, mental health issues surrounding things that happen in our political lives. So I've come at a point where I think that satire does, you know, it's a complex artifact. It's a man-made object in the same way that a hammer is a man-made object. And you use a hammer to hammer things in the wall, and you look at the thing and how it's made, and you can assess that that's what it's doing. I think satire is similarly an artifact like a hammer, but it's more complex. And for a long time, I feel like scholars have been trying to argue that what it's designed to do is change the world. And then, you know, we had all this satire about Donald Trump, and it really didn't change that much about stopping him.
So would you say, is there an element there where is the possibility there that satire could be counterproductive? I've definitely seen that as a commentary. I can't point you to any articles.
Absolutely.
Now.
Yeah.
But the idea that it's actually just entrenches positions.
Yeah.
And so if people feel, let's say they were sympathetic towards a particular political viewpoint, and then very fashionable rich people on television mock them, that's only going to entrench the people within their particular viewpoint rather than get them to change.
I think so. I think, and you know, there's cartoonists. I remember doing a sort of interview with a cartoonist called Tom Tomorrow. His real name is Dan Perkins, and he's kind of progressive cartoonist in what's called the alt weekly tradition in the US. So it's like non-mainstream local newspapers. And now, of course, everything has moved digital, but because it's been going on for a while. I think he said something on the lines like, you know, when I do my satire, I'm obviously not going to try and convince hardcore Republicans. At most, I might maybe swing somebody who's sitting on the fence. But I think there's a lot of kind of scholarship, including, you know, Sophie Quirk in our own school, who's kind of worked on stand-up comedy and politics, and it's the study of preaching to the converted. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because that's what preachers do most of the time. They preach to their converted. And it's, you know, I think satire might have an effect in kind of sustaining communities. Like if you think about the big Trump baby balloon at protests, you can see that's a kind of form of user-generated satire. And I think, you know, well, Trump will be annoyed by it, but I think it, because he gets annoyed by these things. But at the same time, I don't think it will have any kind of meaningful political effect. But it might have some sort of effect in creating a community. And I think also, you know, what's really interesting and what I would like to do a bit more research about if I could is that it seems like preaching to the converted doesn't have much political effect if the converted are on your side. But if the converted are not on your side, it might start to look much more dangerous. So what I'm thinking about is the kind of user-generated satire in online cultures that are associated with the far right or the alt right, or you know, where you see that lots of memes are being produced, and you can see that it's interesting. They sometimes reappropriate GIFs from The Simpsons, which has a fairly left-wing position. And it's this kind of, you know, they're fighting against the liberal elite. And I think part of what these that satirical expression is doing is mocking the liberal elite and therefore kind of constituting a community. And looking at that, I think, you know, that could be a real thing that satire is doing. But on the whole, I think that people have always said, oh, satire speaks truth to power. It changes the world. Well, I don't think it does. I think it might incrementally contribute to some sort of effect in the same way that you might do some volunteering, which might not, for example, solve the problem of homelessness in your hometown, but will do something, and alongside other things might have an effect. So I think, you know, I don't think necessarily that we need to have a cynical viewpoint about satire, that it's necessarily counterproductive. So that would be my answer. But then the other thing is that As an artifact, you know, as a hammer, in that sense, you know, I think it's maybe not primarily designed to have that kind of political effect. But I think to do something around the idea that, for example, Donald Trump is in office, the satire is not going to get him out of office, but it might function as a form of coping that he is in office.
So you're making a distinction here, would you say, between private mental health and some kind of public state of depression, like let's say a public or it's perceived to be generally depressed because whether it might be Brexit or Donald Trump or whatever.
Well, I think that it's not an uncommon idea in some parts of psychiatry that certain mental health conditions, you know, are symptoms of what's going on in a society or reflect what's going on in a society. And I think that a lot of satirists struggle with issues, I think, that we all struggle with, or that a lot of us struggle with, but they might be around climate change or around Brexit or other aspects of our politics. And I'm kind of interested in satire as a way of kind of negotiating, you know, what we should do. And I feel like climate change is a really good one. I think Greta says it's very black and white, right? And yeah, I feel like I should be more like her, but I'm not experiencing it as black and white. I experience it as more grey. I feel like there's a concept that I've become interested in recently is in philosophy called value incompatibility, the idea that I have certain values. For example, I want a greener society, but I have other values as well, in the sense that I want a job or I want to be an academic. And for example, if you're an academic, it's very difficult, I think, to avoid air travel at all, whereas that might, I think, be the most green thing to do. But I think if you want to be the best possible academic, you probably want to deliver keynote lectures abroad, and I feel like there's this real kind of incompatibility, and that's, I think, for me, really, really grey, and I feel kind of bad about that. And I think that's where an interesting kind of area of mental health finds itself, and it's the kind of mental health that it's this kind of spectrum. It's not the kind of schizophrenia or kind of really serious conditions of mental health, but I feel like a kind of aspect of our mental health that I think probably a lot of people are experiencing. And what I find interesting is that, you know, how satire can kind of develop a criticism but at the same time kind of deal with this fact that, okay, maybe this criticism is not enough, or maybe I'm limited and I can't kind of fully pursue my criticism. And in the sense that what we were talking about, The Simpsons or other kind of satire that I'm interested in, being super mainstream and at the same time also critical, that tension then, you know, becomes exactly why I think satire is interesting.
And would you say that you call it a tension, some would call it a contradiction, is one of the ways that, let's say, right-wing commentators or right-wing people would satirise the left in that their hypocrisy on things like climate change, when you've got movie stars getting involved in the campaign, yet they're flying around the world, and other examples like that, or the no matter what The Simpsons, let's say if it was criticising a particular individual, I'm not sure whether it does or whether it doesn't, but it'd be very easy for that individual then to turn around and say, yeah, but you're owned by murder.
Yeah. Well, I think that's interesting to think about whether it's a contradiction or not. And that I think the idea that it could be a contradiction and that there's something that you need to live with, or at least, you know, I think that opens up interesting avenues into thinking about experiences of mental health. And to just to kind of clarify maybe a little bit more around this idea of mental health, lots of satirists describe their making of satire as some sort of act to preserve their sanity, quote unquote sanity, and that's why I got really quite interested in. And a lot of kind of, you know, there's this technique of kind of irony directed at the self and the satirist going like, my satire will change the world. And the idea is that you need to be stupid to think that that's going to be the case. But that doesn't mean that you should stop kind of doing an act of criticism through their satire. So it's really kind of paradoxical. And I think maybe I would prefer the word paradox to contradiction, because the idea is that a paradox is still to some extent resolvable. And there is this kind of image.
You think it is resolvable?
Well, I think there's a tension in our daily, in our lives, which might not be resolvable, but we have to live with it anyway. And I think satire, I think that satirists, or a lot of satirists, are often negotiating that tension in their satire, and that maybe we can borrow from them. And the real tension for me is between this active critique in satire, so you're exposing a kind of social wrongness, so that's a real moral act. And then I think satire is at the same time also entertainment. And entertainment is sort of sitting back and enjoying the show. And I think satire's status is commercial, or whether if you go back further in time, it's kind of associations with the higher classes, or even, you know, in Roman times, right? I think it's because it's entertainment. And it's like, I think an image that I'm kind of thinking about currently is like having a Mr. Whippy at a protest march. There's something wrong about that. I think we could go to the Science Museum and have a Mr. Whippy. That's fine. You know, you could learn, I think, and have a good time at the same time. And I think in our teaching, hopefully that's something that we sometimes aspire to. But doing it at a protest march is really quite paradoxical or contradictory. And that's where I think that satire is interesting. It's this tension between critique and entertainment that I think is central to satire, that might be an interesting kind of platform to explore something about our daily lives. And I think the fact that satirists might be reflexive of that is interesting, because I think there's probably a part of the community who does not experience that contradiction, and Greta Thunberg might be part of that, for who it's not tension, it's just black or white. And maybe that's indeed the best kind of position, but I think for a lot of people they do experience that tension, and it's not that easy to change it overnight. And maybe that is only the second best thing, but okay, these people also need to live their lives in maybe what for them becomes the best possible way. And facing up to that kind of imperfectionism might kind of be a strain on your mental health. You might feel guilty. There's this kind of thing that's called neurotic perfectionism, where you're setting yourself goals which you cannot achieve. Now, if I set myself goals to live a really radically green lifestyle, but that's not something I can achieve, I am probably going to develop issues around self-esteem, maybe even depression. Or think about Brexit, kind of, I'm going to change it. And or maybe this kind of, you know, you feel like you need to change it yourself. And I think then there's this interesting tension where, yes, you need to do things, and I'm, you know, nobody should advocate for complacency, but there's this kind of interesting tension going on. And I think in a lot of satire, that's, you know, a lot of satirists seem to have to come to terms with the fact that the world is sick and they want to cure it, but they can't fully do it. And I feel like that's also something that might be interesting for, you know, an experience that a lot of us go through.
Would you say, this is maybe putting you on the spot a little bit, and don't feel like you have to come up with an answer in particular, but is there like a class-based thing to this, in that there's, I would say, a lot of working class people, these questions of whether they choose to fly and whether they not choose to fly, whether they choose to live green, whether they choose not to live green, where they choose to live, what they choose to do for a living, just cannot be questions because they don't have as much choice on that as people who are living like academics or climate change activists. And I know you can have working class people who are climate change activists, for example, but they're unlikely to be full-time climate change activists.
Yes.
So would you say that there's a class element in some of these examples of satire or examples of problems and paradoxes that you're referring to here?
I think so, yes. And I think probably because it's personal as well, and I think you write from within your own kind of life world. And that, I think to some extent, maybe that's also okay in your research. I think it would be less okay, for example, I think it's really interesting that you brought my awareness to that. And I think, for example, I think class is often the one that we overlook. I think issues of gender and race, for example, are always on the forefront. I think when we develop modules often as well as academics, class is often kind of overlooked.
I've got a theory as to why that is the case, but maybe I'll go into that another time.
I think definitely there's this difference between the problems and the kind of the climate change. I think that's really interesting because we just came back from Brighton, where I was on a conference, which is of course great because it was paid for, and at the same time it was a conference and a bit of a holiday, and so as an academic that's one of your privileges. And so Brighton obviously is very progressive, and I'd like to think of myself as quite progressive, but I also like to think of myself as never progressive enough. And that's kind of what I felt when I was in Brighton as well, that there was this kind of vibe of expecting you to be radical that I couldn't live up to, but at the same time it was extremely middle class, and super middle class as well. So I think there's definitely that. With satire, I think so as well, that I'm not quite sure whether... Yeah, it's a tricky one.
It is tricky, yeah.
Who consumes satire? I wouldn't want to necessarily say that's middle class per se.
No.
But yeah.
I was just raising it more as a question that sprang to mind when you were speaking, rather than expecting a cogent answer on that, because it's clearly complex, as all of this is. And I think what you're talking to me about this is a complexity. And even if we're using the phrase paradox, contradiction, tension, it's talking about the states of grey and the complexity of the issues.
Absolutely. But I feel like worries about Brexit, I don't think are necessarily class. But I think, you know, I think whatever class you're in, if you're living in Britain nowadays, you might have worries about the political world that we live in. And I'm just kind of interested as in satire as a way of dealing with that.
Can I ask you what your So you're looking at satire and mental health, this idea of kind of maybe public states of depression, the tensions and paradoxes and possibly contradictions. Yeah. What specific programs, cartoons, what media are you looking at? Or have you started to look?
Of course. And honestly, where I'm at the kind of writing of the book is I'm kind of seeing what I've done in the PhD thesis and then seeing what I can add and what needs to be added in terms of kind of trying to have an as diverse as possible corpus or body of work to look at. So I'm trying to look at things across different media. So obviously kind of television or what traditionally is television, like for example South Park is definitely in the thesis, which is kind of The Simpsons 2.0 in some respects. Films, I think I want to do maybe something around Black Klansman or Get Out as well, because what's interesting about Get Out is that it's a satire that's not necessarily funny or designed to be funny, and that's something that is a big thing in the literature, and I think that would be really interesting to look at that. I'm kind of interested in literature as well sometimes. I have a background in literature, but I think there's probably going to be a bit about The Handmaid's Tale in there, and it's because that's also kind of transmedia.
So with this stuff like Get Out, The Handmaid's Tale, you're talking these kind of allegorical kind of tales.
Right? They are, and you can then start thinking to which extent the kind of allegory as a form of the work has a kind of influence on the way it deals with these mental health issues. For example, Atwood was writing at the time of the rise of the religious right and Ronald Reagan in America, and that's really interesting to read the book in that kind of background. And then, of course, nowadays the television series is in the era of Trump, and it's just, I think it's interesting when you mentioned kind of allegory, because what she's writing about is really the stuff of nightmares to some extent, and it could have been real, and that's I think why it's partly so haunting. And she says that, you know, I've invented nothing really in The Handmaid's Tale. I think she calls it, it's not science fiction, there's a speculative fiction, I think, or there's this kind of theoretical distinction, and the idea is that this is kind of our world, and she hasn't introduced any kind of technological advances which don't exist yet, and she's based herself wholly on practices associated with particular kind of religions. Now that's the stuff of nightmares, but I think maybe the way it becomes bearable, or like it's contained in that form, that aesthetic form of the allegory. So part of what I'm really interested in is to see what kind of techniques, often narrative techniques, that satirists use when they deal with these issues, and then how we could use those in our day-to-day lives. And stories are super important for us. To some extent, I'm telling a story, and you're telling a story now together, and our personalities are to some extent kind of related to stories as well. So I think like narrative techniques can be a link between the media that we consume and our kind of identities.
So what are the limits of this project? What is it? It's a book, I take it?
Well, the limits are 50,000 words, so and my time. It's a book, but
have you got a title for that book yet?
Yeah, the title, I think the current title is Satire, Comedy and Mental Health, and I think that maybe that's enough. I mean, it's a short form book, and it's trying to, I think it's, you know, the idea that satire is a therapy exists, but it's usually considered to be a therapy for the political illness of the world. And so I'm trying to turn that on its head and say, no, it's really a therapy for coping with the world, not curing it. And then I'm investigating the qualities of entertainment as a way to kind of connect ourselves with a world which we might otherwise lose connection with, and that might lead to depression. The idea is that I think there's many ways to look at depression, but one way to look at it is that people who are depressed have in some way lost connection to their life world. And I think if you can find enjoyment, whether it be rock and roll or something else, that can connect you. And I think, well, an individual who's depressed is definitely not going to make any kind of political change at all. So I think what is interesting is, I think maybe moving beyond the binary between, let's say, radical action and complacency, but something that's sort of more, at some points you need to be able to sit back and enjoy the show. That doesn't mean that that's the only thing you do, but that's also important. And then another thing is exactly what we're talking about with the allegory. It's kind of looking at form, aesthetic form, as ways of dealing with kind of troubled content. And I think especially kind of comedy and humor, because this idea that comedy is good for you or helps for you with your mental health. And I'm trying to be a little bit more precise there. And I think a lot of my research, I'm sometimes a bit embarrassed that I'm doing philosophical research because it doesn't feel sexy enough or empirical enough. But I think a lot of my research is trying to establish what do we mean when we say that, and if you say that comedy has an impact on mental health, exactly like how would that work? And if you're asking me about the limits of the project, well, where I would really want to develop it is a more kind of interdisciplinary collaboration and working together with colleagues in social sciences, for example, or people with experience in healthcare, to kind of see, then test or otherwise implement, these ideas about how satire can be good for your mental health. But first, I feel like somebody needs to investigate how exactly satire can be good for your mental health. And I think like before we've established that, we can't really properly test anything because we're just stabbing in the dark.
Does the book have a publisher, and what's the date of due for publication?
Yeah, the publisher's Emerald. So they've got a new list in Health and Medical Humanities. And I think we're probably at the ideal point, the publisher and myself. Like, I'm kind of also moving into this medical and health humanities, and it's I think a great opportunity. It's a kind of, it will be published in the Points series, which is like short form books that are kind of designed to set a research agenda or to kind of start a conversation about a topic, and that's exactly what I want to do. And I think we're looking probably at a May 2020 date if everything works out.
So what is the difference between satire and mockery? Or satire and pastiche?
Absolutely.
Or?
So satire has this moral dimension. I mean, I can mock somebody, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I've got a moral intention in mind. So it's a moral intention, and I think it's linked to social wrongness. So I think when we satirize something, it's because we cannot agree to disagree about something. I need to take a stand, right? And that's the kind of, we enter into the moral domain when we, you know, we can agree to disagree about which football team to support. But if you're going to ban the practice of football in England, I'm not going to be able to tolerate that, and I'm going to take a moral stand on that. And I think you can take a moral stand, for example, in, I don't know, if my neighbor grows a tree and it falls on and the apples fall on my garden and I feel really petty, I might take a moral stand. But I think that's not what satire is doing. You know, it takes a more kind of approach from a social wrongness. And you might kind of satirize Donald Trump because what he's doing, you think that's wrong from a social perspective. And so there's quite a lot of stuff, and this is something I've written about. I've proposed a definition of satire because I think there's quite a lot of forms of cultural production which are called satire but are not really satirical.
Such as?
Mock the Week. I mean, it's easy to have a go at Mock the Week, but I think for what it is, it's actually pretty good in that sense. But it's a topical panel show. It does comedy. And I think, you know, that's what it's designed to do, and it does it arguably well. It's comedy about politics, and this is, you know, I'm not the first one to say this, and there's a bit of kind of a tradition of research that makes this distinction, and I try to introduce a definition to kind of make that definition or that distinction a bit sharper. So it's comedy about politics. Something happens in the world and Mock the Week is just going to mock it. And they kind of use it as an opportunity to make comedy about. Whereas satire is then more driven by a wrongness which has happened and which should be attacked. But at the same time, it entertains as well. And then it becomes really quite interesting, that tension. So yes, satire, like, say, The Simpsons, because we've been talking about, is entertainment, and Mock the Week is also entertainment, but satire has that extra dimension, I think, of social critique, which mockery lacks.
So it's a more targeted
approach. Yeah, and I think it's a kind of, you're targeting a target which you think is, you know, morally wrong for social reasons.
So this idea of allegory, I mean, is there not a kind of situation now where, because people are very, very educated on media, they're very educated on and very visually literate, that we expect things to stand in for other things?
Well, I'll put my philosopher's hat on and then I'll say something along the lines like, I don't think allegory is necessary for satire. So that's one thing to kind of... get that problem out of the way. But then to kind of approach it more charitably, I don't know, I think, you know, that allegory is one technique that satire uses. And, you know what, I'm not quite sure if it's a problem for the kind of thing that I'm doing, if I'm kind of asking the question, can allegory be a useful technique that we can use in our daily lives for telling the stories that we tell about ourselves or about the world? I think, you know, from an artistic or aesthetic point of view, the idea that it becomes like a trope that becomes commonplace is, I guess, problematic. But maybe for what I'm trying to do, less so. But I'll think about that more.
So, Dieter de Klerk, I really appreciate that. Thanks very much. And we'll pick this up another time, maybe. Maybe when the books come out and you've had some feedback on it, we can do another one of these.
That's great. I really enjoyed it.